This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Michael Dunn shot and killed Jordan Davis in a Jacksonville parking lot in 2012. Dunn fired his gun 10 times. He was charged with first-degree murder and 3 counts of attempted murder. On Saturday this past week, a Jacksonville jury deadlocked on the premeditated first-degree murder charge, but convicted Dunn on the attempted murder charges. ABC News had an exclusive interview with one of the jurors, who said she and a majority of the other jurors thought Dunn was guilty of murder.
We all believed that there was another way out, another option.
Michael Dunn had options.
Oh, yes, sir.
What were his options, you think?
Roll your window up, ignore the taunting, put your car in reverse. That's my feeling.
When does self-preservation turn into premeditation? Does the talk of stand your ground here in Florida confuse the circumstances for a jury in a murder case? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN, the Florida Roundup at 800-743-9576. You can email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. And tweet us using the handle @WLRN. Andrew Pentazzi is with the Florida Times Union. Eric Barton along with us as well, a freelancer for the BBC and editor of The Rundown in Miami. Both of you, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Andrew, let's begin in Jacksonville. Describe the courtroom verdict and what we've learned about the conversations and the debate that was going on inside that jury room a week ago.
So basically what we had is Michael Dunn was charged with 5 different counts. He was convicted on 4 of those, but the main count, that's the murder in the first degree or premeditated murder count, was a deadlock. One juror said that it ended with a 9-3 vote. They could not decide whether he was guilty or not, so eventually they had to declare a mistrial, but only on that count. He has been convicted on the other 4 counts. There will be a pre-sentencing investigative report, and he'll be sentenced on those counts, and then it looks like there's going to be a retrial on that murder count. Now, the mood around the courtroom, there were a lot of protesters out once they heard the verdict that he was not convicted on the murder count. They ended up marching to the state attorney's office. But basically, this is your classic stand your ground case that we've been seeing more of.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting here, Eric, is we describe it as a classic stand your ground case. Folks are looking at this via stand your ground laws, but stand your ground was not asserted during the testimony of the defense for Michael Dunn.
Yeah, you do have to wonder, though, if stand your ground is really giving people the feeling that they can face down kids at a gas station instead of driving away, just like the juror said.
Right, that in fact there was an option for retreat that Mr. Dunn possibly may have had, considering they were in a parking lot, and he had a vehicle that he could have driven away with.
And the question we have to ask now is, does stand your ground embolden people to not drive away?
Yeah, well, let's put that to a famed defense attorney, Alan Dershowitz, with Harvard Law School and a part-time South Florida resident. He joins us from Miami Beach. Professor Dershowitz, this first-degree murder charge in the Dunn case, how did that impact, do you think, the strategy, especially the claim of self-defense that we heard on the stand?
Well, it totally destroyed the credibility of the prosecution. The prosecution, on the one hand, argued that he shot impulsively because he had been dissed. He had been disrespected, loud shouts, and maybe a racial taunt. If that was true, then this is a second-degree murder case, not a first-degree murder case. There's no theory under which, from a common sense point of view, you can say that Dunn premeditated this murder, and yet he was charged with premeditated murder. And when you do that, 2 things happen. Number one, you lose your credibility with the jury. Number two, you get 12 people on the jury instead of 6. And when you get 12 people on the jury, that increases the chance substantially of getting a hung jury. You're more likely to get disagreement with 12 than you are with 6. So Angela Corey blew this case from day one, as she has blown the Zimmerman case and many other cases. Any good prosecutor should have been able to get a murder conviction in this case.
And she, of course, is the state prosecutor that was involved in this case. Andrew Pentazzi with the Florida Times Union talked to the points that Professor Dershowitz points out in terms of the intent. How did the prosecution go about trying to prove that? What was the role of the jury instructions in understanding the intent necessary beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that first-degree murder charge?
So basically what you have here with premeditated murder, that's a very heavy burden you have to meet. You have to prove that Mr. Dunn actually premeditated, that he intended to kill as he was shooting. And the way they were trying to prove that is they talked about the weight of pressure you have to put on the trigger. It's about 6.25 pounds of pressure, and that he shot 10 times at the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to argue that because of that intention, and then because it was in a holster, he had to grab it out, that he had enough time to think about what he was doing, and he decided he intended to kill.
But that would turn every second-degree murder case into a first-degree murder case. Every second-degree murder case involves pressing the trigger. It involves taking it out of the holster. Look, Angela Corey just doesn't understand the role of prosecutor. She is a just terrible, terrible prosecutor.
She's always
overcharging these cases.
Professor Dershowitz,
that's her standard.
Let's talk a little bit about this. The reasonable doubt threshold for first-degree murder, reasonable doubt and premeditation. I have sat on a first-degree murder trial, and the way the intent was described to me in my jury instructions was not a period of time, not a necessarily a second or a minute of intent. It can happen in a flash. Did they act with the intent to kill?
You do give that instruction, but any reasonable juror will disregard that instruction. That is a stupid argument, because when you make that argument, it eliminates the distinction between second and first degree murder. Every second degree murder involves some degree of deliberation. Guns don't go off accidentally. And the legislature deliberately distinguished between second and first degree murder. That goes back to the earliest days of our constitutional history, when Pennsylvania was the first jurisdiction in the world to distinguish first and second degree murder. And the distinction was between people who sit and wait, people who poison others, people who are hitmen, who deliberate and plan to kill. And then you get prosecutors and sometimes judges who try to eliminate the distinction by saying that premeditation can occur in the instant, in the split second.
Mm-hmm.
That's just ridiculous. And that undercuts
the distinction
between second and first degree murder, and juries don't buy it.
Go ahead, Andrew.
What's going to be particularly interesting to watch is that, because even on the attempted murder counts, they only got second degree.
Right.
And you could argue that it would be easier to get first degree on those because the car was driving away as he continued to shoot. On the retrial, Angela Corey has indicated she intends to again seek first degree. And if she doesn't seek second degree, it'll be interesting to see how much of the testimony is focused on trying to prove premeditation happening in a split second.
And I will point out that we invited the prosecutor, Ms. Corey, from Jacksonville to participate in this discussion today, and she declined our invitation for the interview. I do want to talk here a little bit about Stand Your Ground, because as we've noted here, Eric Barton, it was not asserted as a defense in this case. This was a self-defense argument that Michael Dunn and his attorneys were making. But in your estimation, does this confuse the circumstances, even as the jury has to go behind closed doors to decide what happened?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, one of the things about this case is right from the beginning, everybody thought this is a test of Stand Your Ground. Even if they don't use it in the trial, it is, if he got off here, it would have emboldened more people to say, look, I was acting the same way Michael David Dunn did. Now, what happens now? He was convicted of attempted murder. So in the next case like this, will the defense take Stand Your Ground?
Yeah. Professor Dershowitz, is this confusing for a jury, even if Stand Your Ground is not asserted by the attorneys? Listen, I mean, with the Zimmerman case out there from 6 months ago, this case, most jurors are going to walk into that room with some basic understanding or perhaps misunderstanding of Stand Your Ground.
Look, I hate Stand Your Ground. It's a terrible law. It's an NRA-imposed vigilante invitation to kill if you're disrespected. This is not a Stand Your Ground case. Why? If, in fact, the jury believed, I didn't believe, but if the jury believed that he thought he saw a shotgun, he had no opportunity to retreat. Getting into your car when somebody is aiming a shotgun at you is not a reasonable thing to do. If he honestly believed he saw a shotgun aiming at him, he was entitled to shoot back. Without Stand Your Ground, he didn't have to retreat. If there was a situation where he saw a knife, for example, and he could have easily rolled up the window and gotten away, that would be a Stand Your Ground case. But the reason he didn't assert Stand Your Ground, although in the closing argument, the defense attorney did refer to Stand Your Ground, saying the judge will charge Stand Your Ground, but the reason they didn't make a big deal of it, it would be inconsistent with his basic defense. His basic defense is he saw a guy aiming a shotgun at him. You can't escape from a shotgun by getting in your car and driving away. So he had no alternative but to shoot to defend himself.
Andrew,
so Stanier Brown is not really centrally involved in this case, except that it conceivably could encourage people to shoot when they have a real alternative to leave.
Andrew Pentazzi with the Florida Times Union. Go ahead.
I do feel I need to clarify. This was a Stand Your Ground case. In the jury instructions, they were specifically instructed that he had the right to stand his ground, that he was not required to retreat if given the option or opportunity to retreat. It's similar to the George Zimmerman case.
But that's also included in self-defense. It's also included in a self-defense defense of one's actions.
But the defendant,
well, yes, in every self-defense case now includes the Stand Your Ground law in the jury instructions.
That's right, whether or not it was used within the testimony of the case or not.
But again, you can't compare this case to Zimmerman. The verdict in the Zimmerman case was absolutely correct.
Professor Dershowitz, hold on.
Any jury in any state in the United States,
Professor Dershowitz,
if they had reasonable doubt about whether or not Zimmerman's head was being banged against the floor when he shot. That's a very simple case. This is a much more complicated case because in this case, you have to believe a story which seemed very unplausible on its face. And nine of the jurors didn't believe that story. Three of the jurors maybe did, maybe didn't, maybe had some questions about first degree, second degree. But to compare the Zimmerman case to this case is to compare apples and bicycles.
Professor Alan Dershowitz of Howard Law School. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, I agree. This is a very different case. It's a much more complicated case because what is at issue here is, do you believe that Mr. Dunn had a reasonable fear that bodily harm was going to be caused to him? So his main argument is that Jordan Davis exited the vehicle. Other witnesses said that Jordan Davis did not exit the vehicle. But if you believe that occurred, or if you believe that he did see a weapon, whether it was a pipe or a shotgun, or whatever else he says he saw, then that comes to the expectation that he had the right to stand his ground and did not need to find a means of retreat, even if one were offered to him. You did make the point that he was in his car, so whether he had an opportunity to retreat or not is an interesting case. But one of the other drivers at the gas station had made the point that he pulled in next to the Dodge Durango, heard the loud music, didn't like the loud music, so he pulled out and moved into a further away parking spot.
Andrew Pentazzi with Florida Times Union. Let me ask you, in the jury instructions, did they have the option to find guilty of murder of a lesser degree?
Sure. Yes. They charged him with first degree on the attempteds and on the murder. And then they had the opportunity to also go with second degree or go to manslaughter.
And to be clear, they didn't find any of those. They hung on the murder charge entirely.
Exactly.
And in Zimmerman also, they had the option.
And in Zimmerman as well.
But once you overcharge, as they did in Zimmerman, as they did here, the credibility is so impacted that jurors often won't go to the second or lower offenses. They just don't believe the prosecution. And once the prosecution loses its credibility, often it's very difficult to regain it.
And it's the burden of proof, of course, that rests with the prosecution. Professor Alan Dershowitz with Harvard Law School joining us from Miami Beach. Professor Dershowitz, thank you so much. Now, the Dunn trial has prompted scrutiny again of Florida's gun laws. This week, a group of mayors announced they would unite and use the municipal buying power of firearms to combat gun violence. Former Miami Herald journalist Casey Woods and her organization Arms with Ethics devised this program. Coral Gables Mayor Jim Kaysen.
If you don't cooperate with us, if you don't help us keep guns out of the hands of criminals, we're just not going to spend our tax dollars with your company.
This is purportedly, Eric, a market solution to the proliferation of guns. The effort to really circumvent the legislative and the judicial process, doesn't it?
It does, although there is a Florida law that restricts whether municipalities can pass their own gun laws. And any politician who passes a law in Miami-Dade could get a fine from the state and be removed from the governor.
To argue the legal points, but could this be considered a gun law or simply a municipal budgeting, a fiduciary responsibility trying to gather together the buying power of police districts to get the best deal possible for the taxpayers when they have to buy firearms?
That's a good question, but I'm sure the NRA would say that it... it would fall under that law.
Andrew Pantazzi, I know you've been covering the Michael Dunn case here, but talk to us a little bit about the view of firearms and this idea of municipal buying power, perhaps trying to harness market forces and force gun manufacturers into agreeing to a code of ethics.
No, it is very interesting because in the state of Florida, as you stated, municipalities basically they can't have laws that supersede the state legislation. So this is an interesting mechanism they're using, trying to prevent it. And what we're seeing up here in North Florida, where it is perhaps a little more conservative than in South Florida, mm-hmm. is even some of the conservative politicians, including the Duval County, the Jacksonville sheriff, saying that he would support changes to right now self-defense and to gun legislation, perhaps tweaking being needed, he said.
And all of this is happening, Eric, as you've detailed in some reporting, an increased use of firearms in homicides, even as violent crime rates have been declining.
Yeah, over the last 10 years, murders have basically remained constant in Florida as a percentage of the population. But in 2000, about 50% of the murders in Florida happened by gun. Now it's about 75%.
Any reason why that is? Any speculation even from learned folks about the increased use of firearms in homicides?
It depends on where you stand on gun ownership.
Sure.
You know, there are about 1 million guns purchased legally in the state of Florida every year. So people who are for gun control say this is an indication that more guns on the street will commit more crimes. Supporters of guns will say all these new guns are on the street, but yet the murders have stayed the same.
Do we have any data informing us of whether or not the guns involved in those, the increased number of guns involved in the homicides are being purchased legally with proper permits and background checks or not?
It doesn't connect to that, but there are, they say, 20% of all guns used in crimes have been purchased illegally. So as a statistic as a whole, that's true.
Eric Barton, a freelancer for the BBC and editor of The Rundown in Miami. Andrew Pantazzi with the Florida Times Union. Andrew, thank you for joining us from Jacksonville here today on the Florida Roundup. Still to come, cursive calculus. Stay for Common Core. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Common Core is staying in the Sunshine State, but don't call it Common Core. Call it Florida Standards now. That's the new name. This week, the Florida State Board of Education voted to keep calculus and cursive writing in those standards and to change the name of the strategy to Florida Standards. Here's Education Commissioner Pam Stewart.
I think the vote that the board took today certainly does lay to rest where we're headed, the direction we're going with our standards, and this is the right move. I applaud the State Board of Education that they did, in fact, do just what the governor said, and that is strengthen Florida standards.
Florida State Senate President Don Gates, meantime, says he'd still like to make some adjustments to how Common Core, or now known as Florida Standards, is taught.
When you look at the materials used to teach students, that's where some of the criticism has come in. So there's legislation that would make clear that the selection of instructional materials is up to the local school board.
So is Common Core the right direction for Florida public education? We continue to move in that direction as we move into full implementation of the standards, or rather the strategies, next school year. Parents, teachers, students, what's your experience with Common Core? Let us know at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. If you're on your lunch break, the 20 minutes that you get to eat lunch in public schools in South Florida, let us know at 800-743-9576. Or you can send us a tweet, use the call sign at WLRN. Sammy Mack is our state impact WLRN education reporter here. What's the message being sent, Sammy, by this name change?
Well, the message being sent is it's the same thing, but please don't be upset about it anymore. I mean, that's basically at the heart of this. Common Core is becoming extremely politically divisive, and the standards themselves are not really changing. When I talk about it, I talk about it as Common Core because that's what it is.
That's what the 45 states adopted from the Department of Education.
Yeah.
It's a strategy. It's not a curriculum. There are standard goals that they want the kids to be able to fulfill each and every year.
And there are some really esoteric conversations to be had around the language of it itself. And there is some hope from the folks who are supporters of these standards, period, that changing the name will make it easier for families and teachers and parents and students to digest. But it is... The core of it is still the same.
Is it cosmetics? It's labeling, it's marketing, it's branding?
There are a few actual tweaks to the standards, but for the most part, yes. And in fact, most of the changes that happened were clarifications of the standards and not actual changes to the standards themselves. It was just making it even more clear what the core standard was.
Two of those that have gotten plenty of attention are kind of one on the younger demographic, shall we say, younger students, one on older students. The younger students is cursive writing, teaching cursive writing and standards via cursive writing. And then the older students is with calculus. So bridge this gap here. What was important about these two particular skills that the Department of Education felt it needed to clarify when it comes to Florida standards?
Cursive is a really interesting one because it is an incredibly emotionally charged sort of topic for people who are riled up about it.
Mm-hmm.
It had not been included in the standards, and it was sort of an addition that Florida put in there. And when you hear people talk about cursive writing, they get this like sort of wistful tone in their voice, like, how will children write love letters? How will they read legal documents? And
write thank you notes.
Write thank you notes. And yeah. And it's really, really interesting, the sort of conversation that has come around that. So children, you know, will be expected to learn cursive. And they kind of, not all places had been teaching it.
Right,
so this is sort of interesting. We had a great essay from Neda Borges, who is a teacher who writes op-eds for us occasionally. And she pointed out that cursive, the fight over cursive from where she stands in the classroom, is more than just about penmanship.
So what, yeah, exactly. I mean, it seems to be, this isn't, it is about cursive, but it's always more than that. It is perhaps about the unwillingness of fully turning our back on what had always been thought of as core skills that public school students needed to have, including just basic cursive writing.
Right. And if you've got kids who are not getting that particular skill in school, then it's sort of almost a symbol of the other things that they're not
getting
in school.
Yeah.
That, you know, maybe other kids are learning cursive, they're not doing it at school, their parents are teaching it to them. But her point was, you know, not all kids have those kinds of outside of school resources and support systems.
1-800-743-9576. No cursive writing necessary to dial the phone if you want to join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN. Cursive writing and calculus. Tackle calculus, because math and science, of course, has been a big focus of Common Core and the supporters about improving America's standing in the world when it comes to public education on math and science. Calculus being some of the advanced math, of course, that high school graduates can be armed with as they move into their K through 12 years. What was the clarification?
Well, it was, Florida had, first of all, Florida had Florida standards before it had Common Core state standards. And this is one of those things that there's continuity in there and what is expected of kids. So that was one of the opportunities where the state said, we want continuity here. Teachers have spoken, parents have spoken. We want this to continue the way that we have been doing it.
I got to ask you about testing standards here, because every time we talk about Common Core, we have to look forward to September of next year, I guess August of next year, when it's full implementation, K through 12, all grade levels, public schools in Florida will be expected to know Common Core. I just tweeted a photo out of my third grader's homework. Test prep says PARCC,
mm-hmm.
Park Test Prep,
but
which
that's
had
not
been
what they will be taking.
Which they're not taking. He's getting prepared to take the FCATs in a few weeks, but they're prepping also for these Park tests, which in most likelihood won't exist for Florida students next year.
It will be something else, and I have been saying this every time I've been on your show for the past few weeks. Like, we don't know what's coming. We really don't know what's coming. But I did hear something really interesting from Andy Ford, who is the head of Florida's big teacher union organization. And what he mentioned is that, you know, we know from other states that have implemented new standardized tests, those standardized tests take a dip. They're new tests. teachers don't know how to teach the strategy for doing well on those tests. There's a lot of things at play about why there's a dip in the beginning. What he's very concerned about, and what a lot of teachers are very concerned about, is that if that is a known phenomenon, they're concerned that their salaries and money for their schools is still going to be tied to how they perform on those tests. And that's another thing that we don't know about, if, you know, what accommodations are going to be made frequently with testing in Florida.
Two big financial implications, not only the test itself and the preparation, the dollars, the millions of dollars that will be spent in terms of the production of the test, but also the attached for performance that schools can have and teachers can have as well. Sabian joins our conversation here from Miramar on the Florida Roundup. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hello. I just had a comment about the cursive education of cursive in primary schools. I attended a kindergarten back in Latin America, and the first type of writing we learned was cursive writing. So it's important to note that in the long run, cross-cultural communication is something that's going on all the time, and sometimes while people may be able to read print, they might only be able to write in cursive. So it's important to have that background as a primary student. And as far as calculus goes, it's definitely a necessity in today's world where you can't escape technology.
Yep.
You have to be able to know the basic mathematical concepts behind why programming works, why computer science works the way it does, and to push our students to seek more STEM-related careers. And have that inner manufacturing growth that we want to see in America.
Sabian, thank you for the comments. STEM being science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Michelle joins our conversation here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I wanted to comment that I think one of the pervasive issues concerning Common Core overall is a lack of teacher training and teacher education, particularly in the state of Florida, in reference to their capacity to even be able to teach some of the concepts that they're going to have to teach, particularly in math, but also in language arts. You know, in terms of teaching text-based information, you're going to find many teachers don't know how to analyze text themselves to be able to teach informational text properly in the fullest capacity that they should be able to do that.
Are you an educator?
Yes, I am. Actually, I'm a professor of education. And I think we should all have great concern, not about the fact that our teachers don't have these skills, many of them, as it stands today, but that we're going to be evaluating teachers on student achievement on Common Core exams without teachers being given the time they need to train, to prepare, and to implement not only the concepts and the skills, but be able to then translate that to test scores, which ideally we wouldn't even be evaluating teachers based on student test scores, but that is a value-added measure they're going to be doing.
Michelle, thank you for the conversation and the input here. Sammy, part of this conversation is the clock ticks down, of course, to the middle of August and the beginning of the next school year is, of course, the ability and the willingness of the state to put those standards out, to put those strategies and the goals out, to allow the teachers the time to absorb those and get the necessary training administrators to put together the kind of education that's necessary, not only for the teachers and the staff, but also the parents and the caregivers and the students as well. In the meantime, you can't stop time. It marches forward.
Yeah, the state over the past couple of years has had some teacher training programs. They've had this sort of roadshow that they've taken around the state. A lot of districts have been doing their own training of teachers, but it's still, you know, you'll talk to superintendents and educators themselves, and a lot of teachers feel like they still need more time to figure out how to do what the state is asking of them.
Sammy Mack covering education issues for State Impact and for WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. Let's go into Latin America now. In Venezuela this week, more violence and protesting as prices rise, inflation skyrockets, and an opposition leader faces charges. Leopoldo Lopez hauled away this week by Venezuela police on Tuesday. But before he was arrested, he recorded a video message calling on the Venezuelan president and the opponents to the president to peacefully increase demonstrations.
Venezuela hoy más que nunca necesita que tú, que nos estás viendo.
More than ever, Lopez said, Venezuela needs all of us to make a commitment to wanting change. But that commitment can't be passive.
With the translation there, Tim Padgett, our America's editor here on WLRN Miami Herald News. Tim is with us now on the Florida Roundup. The charges have changed for Lopez from Tuesday to today, haven't they, Tim?
Well, originally the charges were outlandish because there have been about five people, I think, up to now killed in these largely student protests. The president, the socialist president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, decided he was going to blame Lopez, who's one of the top opposition leaders. He was going to blame Lopez for the murders and charged him with murder, which, as I said in my piece this week, was, you know, a pretty kangaroo justice move.
Yeah, and they backed down from those charges.
They backed down, finally dropped those charges, but he is still facing charges like terrorism, et cetera.
The protests themselves, while Lopez has been certainly the face of the protests, at least according to the government, this is really about this economy falling apart in a very fast and furious way.
No, these protests are about the socialist government's utter incompetence and authoritarian response to crises like you mentioned, the hyperinflation, the chronic shortage of goods, South America's worst violent crime rate.
Inflation, I think, is 60% now.
It's getting there.
Running very, very fast. You've got shortages of really life necessity goods. Mm-hmm. The black market is trading in the U.S. dollar, I think, 10 times what its official value is, according to the government.
There's a currency crisis. All of the reasons for these protests are legitimate. The economy has been vastly mismanaged in Venezuela. The problem for the opposition is Leopoldo Lopez really the face that's going to draw more people to the opposition side? The problem is that Leopoldo Lopez, despite the fact that he's a very passionate and popular opposition leader, is seen by the poor in Venezuela as sort of a member of the wealthy elite. And that he has troubles connecting with those poor communities. And those are the communities that the opposition has to win over if they're going to change the political math in Venezuela.
Up until the last couple of weeks, I suppose, as Lopez has gained a notoriety outside of Venezuela with the international media focused on it, had been Enrique Capriles, who'd been really the face of the opposition.
Right. Lopez is very popular, for example, with the Venezuelan diaspora here in Venezuelan enclaves like Doral and Weston. But back in Venezuela, the more successful opposition leader has been Capriles because he has proven as a state governor there that he's a little bit more in touch with what the poor in Venezuela were turning to socialist leaders like Hugo Chavez for in the first place. And that's one of the reasons he almost beat Maduro last year in the special election to succeed Chavez.
What do we know about the relationship between Capriles and his supporters and Lopez and his supporters?
Well, the Capriles brings a little bit more of a tempered, a more moderate approach. That's why he has never really been for, you know, going out with these sort of rambunctious protests that Lopez
has he been present in the last couple of weeks as these protests have grown violent and more numerous?
He has, but his presence has been more subdued.
Mm-hmm.
Because his philosophy is that you're not going to win over, again, those poorer members of Venezuela society by throwing Molotov cocktails at a socialist government that many of the poor see as having improved their living conditions over the past decade or so.
And the United States here, Tim, where is the U.S. Diplomatic Corps on this, the State Department on this?
Well, three diplomats were expelled this week because Nicolás Maduro loves to scapegoat anybody he can find.
And the argument was that President Maduro was doing that to deflect attention away from some of the streets in Venezuela.
That's his M.O.,
right.
and it always has been, unfortunately. But there's really not much the United States can do at this point except make calls for Lopez's release, which President Obama did this week. But I think they're just sort of holding back and letting Maduro make all the mistakes he can, and he's accommodating.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for WLRN. In Haiti, meantime, Tim, just yesterday, an appeals court ruled that the former dictator, Jean-Claude Duvalier, can be charged with crimes against humanity. He had claimed that there was a statute of limitations against these crimes that happened during his dictatorship of that island nation. The importance of the decision, not just really for the victims, but also for Haiti and its standing in the world.
There's no doubt. I mean, this could have very important implications in terms of creating a better culture of rule of law in Haiti, which Haiti desperately needs if it's going to break out of its condition as the poorest country in the hemisphere. And it was international rights groups, et cetera, that sort of put pressure on the government to hold hearings that eventually led to this week's ruling. And so there's a lot amongst those groups to celebrate.
And it seems important that this was a ruling not from some international court, not at The Hague, but inside Haiti.
Right. I mean, 3 years ago when Duvalier made his stunning return to Haiti, he was charged with corruption. But a lot of people were shocked that he was not charged with these crimes against humanity, given how allegedly the Duvalier dictatorship in the 20th century terrorized Haiti. And so again, there was pressure in the past few years put on the government to allow these hearings that included Duvalier's alleged victims. And I think that then sort of swayed the judges to realize that, no, this statute of limitations argument may not hold water anymore. And therefore, it looks as though Duvalier will probably now go on trial.
In the meantime, the current administration in Haiti has in the past extended hands to the former dictator, has extended a
well,
hand
that's one of the
problems.
That's one of the problems that international human rights organizations will tell you is that the current president, Michel Martelly, has in the past expressed a little bit too much sympathy for their liking for the whole Duvalier period, and they felt that that was one of the reasons why 3 years ago the judges in Haiti did not bring those charges of like murder, torture, right, etc., against Baby Doc.
What do we know about the prosecutorial ability now to bring these charges, since the appeals court has said the statute of limitations doesn't exist for these charges? Presumably, the road is open now to actually bring the charges.
That'll be the test. Yeah. The charges haven't actually been formally brought. What they've said is that they've green-lighted the process.
That's right.
Saying that he can go on trial. Now we get to see how well the Haitian judicial infrastructure can actually follow through on this, and that'll be a huge test.
Tim Padgett will watch that test here for us as the America's editor here at WLRN, Miami Herald News. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, art destruction and local support for artists. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. The Perez Art Museum Miami opened in the Bayfront in Miami in time for Art Basel. $131 million, 200,000 square feet to celebrate art. On Sunday, 51-year-old Maximo Caminero did not think there was enough local artists hanging on the walls and in the display space. He picked up a piece of pottery as part of a work by Chinese dissident Ai Weiwei and dropped it on the floor, smashing it. Jane Wooldridge is the digital arts editor and business editor at the Miami Herald. Alicia Zuckerman is editorial director here at WLRN. And Eric Barton, freelancer for the BBC and editor of The Rundown in Miami, joining me, Tom Hudson, here on the Florida Roundup. Jane, how much are local artists represented in PAM?
Well, I can tell you that PAM has, I was looking back at this the other day, it has actually rather a long history of doing exhibitions around local artists. That's been that case for at least a decade.
Go ahead.
And I was going to say there are two exhibitions solely devoted to local artists coming up this year that have been planned for several years. One opened shortly, that's around Edouard Duval-Carré. And the other one is around Adler Garrier, who a lot of people here may not be as familiar with unless they're really into the local art scene. But in fact, he is a very strong emerging artist.
And as this has come out, Alicia, after this demonstration, after this destruction, after this alleged crime of destruction, is it a matter of acknowledgement of the support for local art that hadn't been there prior to this a week ago?
I don't think so. I think that this is a question of know what you're protesting if you're going to stage a protest. I don't think that this was a particularly well-informed artist. I also want to make the point that by highlighting the artists of the Americas, and especially of Latin America, as this museum is certainly doing, that is, in my opinion, highlighting the art of this community. And I say that as an editor here, because when we think about the kinds of stories we cover, the stories that are happening in Haiti, the stories that are happening throughout Latin America, are the stories of this community. We have an America's editor, Tim Padgett, right, who you just heard from. In that way, I think there's an analogy to be made. This museum is actually, as you just heard from Jane, highlighting local artists when appropriate, but also the artists of the Americas, which are our artists in a lot of ways.
Well, we spoke yesterday with Mr. Carminero, and in fact, we talked to him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps because of what was in the police report, which is what we've all quoted from, we have actually mischaracterized, or he thinks now that we have mischaracterized what he did. First off, he is calling it a protest performance, which follows a tradition of performance art. If you're not into that. You may not be familiar with it, but in fact, that's a widespread practice, not when it involves destroying another artist's work.
Right.
But there's a larger question here, not just around PAM, not just around local museums, but I think the larger question that he's trying to get at is Miami itself a place that is supportive for artists to work?
Yeah, and Eric Barton, I mean, that's a question that local artists and their creative class have been asking for generations. This is nothing new with the opening of PAM. This is nothing new over the last decade or so and the explosion of Art Basel and the international art community focused on Miami. This is something that's not even unique really to South Florida. This is probably something that every creative class asks of their community.
Yeah, I spoke this morning with Marcus Bickler, a really talented South Florida artist. And, you know, he is often frustrated that he can get shows in New York or Houston, but not in South Florida. Mm. And, you know, while he doesn't support smashing someone else's art, he is glad, like a lot of artists, that we're having this discussion.
Yeah, certainly in a big, big way here on the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. If you're a local artist, a consumer of art, an art gallery owner, one who just likes to admire the creativity that is all-encompassing here in South Florida, let us know. Heather joins us from Miami. She's a member of the Public Insight Network. Welcome to the program, Heather. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me. I definitely want to speak. I'm an artist myself. I'm a musician. But the same thing you were just saying, the artist, I get gigs when I go to New York, when I go to Atlanta. I even have people calling me from California. I haven't even landed there yet. And when I'm in South Florida, it's really hard to get the same kind of exposure and respect and acknowledgement. And I see that happening for all artists across. When Miami-Dade is as big as it is, and you can go to Cutler Bay and you can't have a proper conversation with someone who lives there about what's going on in Wynwood, that really disturbs me. And it makes me wonder, why is it that, you know, and we have so many South Floridians that have jobs that can afford to support their local artists.
You know, Heather,
if only they knew they existed.
Yeah, Heather, this really goes to the point, and Alicia, this goes to the point of community engagement. This isn't about artists ruining other art works here in a moment. It's about the ability and the interest that a community is going to take in this kind of creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, I mean, just speaking to the point of musicians, Heather, as you just did. Heather, is Heather still on the line? What kind of musician are you?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, what kind of musician are you?
I'm a vocalist and a piano player, and I have a band.
Okay, so we have a story in the works right now that was pitched to us by a freelance reporter about rock bands having a hard time booking gigs in Miami, and that in Miami-Dade and in South Florida in general, that South Florida is not the most conducive environment for rock musicians in particular. But we just saw the Van Dyke close, and I was there for the last night of the Van Dyke, and we saw all of these jazz musicians who said, you know, this is not an easy place to build a career as a jazz musician. And PAX, which was touted as one of the great new venues for live music, recently closed. And so I think it's something else now. But nevertheless, we see these kinds of struggles among artists, among the creative class, as you said. It's not a place where it's particularly easy. And there's a ton of support for people in the arts.
It stretches across art disciplines. But I guess the question, Jane Wooldridge with the Miami Herald, is it any more pronounced or unique in this location versus other major metropolitan areas?
I think the answer is to some degree yes and some degree no.
I would agree with that.
And it also has to do with a lot of local forces. I think since Art Basel came here, and there was certainly an arts community here prior to that, but Art Basel has put a lot of emphasis on visual arts. And so it's a little bit easier, I think, now, not 10 years ago, for visual artists. It's kind of a hipster thing. But remember that the Night Arts Challenge, which is currently underway for this year's submissions, has done an enormous amount to support artists here and to support the ideas of individual artists. You don't have to be a big organization to get a big grant.
Right. There's a recognition that there's a need for this. We talk about it a lot, which is a start. I mean, that's good that we're talking about it.
Stefano, who gave us this comment via our Public Insight Network, owns a gallery in the Design District, wrote this, quote, "Do local artists deserve to be in a museum? Are they good enough? Or should they simply have the privilege of showing in a great museum because of the label local, in spite of the quality of their works?"
Well, I, of course, would argue that if you are trying to build an arts museum of any sort, but particularly in Pam's case, with an international recognition level, that you have to have a certain standard of what you include. It needs to include local artists who meet that standard and non-local artists who meet that standard. But you can't lower your standards because the guy lives around the corner.
Right.
That's a different subject from something else I was going to mention, though, is that visual arts doing pretty well here. This has not been a great place for live music performance for a very right. long time, and that is in part perhaps due to the fact that it's a big DJ culture, and there are cultural waves of things that find, you know, more and less support here, and support can come in a lot of ways. I think one of the conversations that's gone on is artists and arts help build neighborhoods into becoming a hip place to stay, and then you can't afford to live there anymore.
Eric Barton, I want to pick up on what Jane Wooldridge is talking about, because while we're concentrating on this incident, this alleged crime that happened in Miami on the Bayfront, of course, you know, there's lots of wonderful visual art museums and other art museums throughout the entire South Florida area. I'm thinking particularly in Broward with the Fort Lauderdale Museum, and of course, lots of great performing arts centers as well, including the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. There's the arts district that's trying to get up and rolling in Fort Lauderdale. There's another one in Lake Worth area. So this is about a sense of place and about peculiarities, perhaps, about this one incident. But there is and has been institutional support across the region of this kind of art support.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it is worth noting that there are some museums like the Art Center in Hollywood and the Bonnet House that have all Florida shows that you should go to. They're amazing. And it's all Florida artists.
Yeah. So the idea, I guess, Alicia, is some of these museums do not only acknowledge the need, perhaps, to showcase Florida art, the talk about the necessity of that and go straight to that point and almost to the exclusion of any artist that is not local.
Yeah. I mean, this is the inherent challenge, though, of any major museum, coming back to the idea of PAM, which is a major museum and wanting to be a major museum on the international stage. You know, you want to be a place where if you're coming in from out of town, you know that's on your list of things to do. Like, you have to go hit PAM, you have to see. And that's not going to happen if the majority of the artists there, probably, at least early on, if the majority of the artists there are local artists. However, you also need the museum to be a place where the community feels like it is their museum. And that's not going to happen if it's primarily artists who are, you know, from other places, who are artists that everybody's heard of but have nothing to do with South Florida. So this is the inherent challenge, I think, of any major museum.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that I was really struck this week when I went over to PAM before this incident happened. I was there on Saturday with some friends, and how this idea that seemed to be, you know, you wondered how much of this might have been PR spin,
mm-hmm.
the idea of it as Miami's front porch.
Right.
And I have to say, I was over there on Saturday. The place was packed. The front porch was packed with some people who had gone to see the art and some who had not. People were sitting there. It was a great scenario. So I think you have to reflect a sense of place, but you do not necessarily have to focus entirely to take ownership of it.
Part of that is the building. I mean, that's an amazing Herzog and de Meuron, who are not Miami architects,
well,
built building, and people really come for the building. I mean, anyone who's interested in architecture and art is going to come to see that building.
It is about location. It is South Florida and real estate, after all. We'll leave it there here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back on the program Saturday morning, 6 a.m., and of course, a little bit later on digitally at WLRN.org. It's produced by Elaine Shin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our public insight network analyst is Steph Farrow. Executive producer Peter J. Merritt, technical supervisor Paul Leary. Stay tuned for South Florida Arts Beat. Next, live jazz vocalist Brenda Alford in Studio A here at WLRN. And I'm back with you Monday morning at 9 a.m. for Sugar on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.